This is Willard Thompson inviting you to join us for a behind-the-scenes visit with the men responsible for educational radio, the men who direct the universities of the air. These are the men who formulate the policies, who decide what will be heard and when. And our guests today are three of the outstanding men in educational radio, Mr. Parker Wheatley, director of Lowell Institute of Cooperative Broadcasting Council of Boston, Mr. George Probst, director of radio, faculty member, and social scientist of the University of Chicago, and Mr. Russell Porter, coordinator of radio at the University of Denver. Their subject, what is the job of educational radio? First, Mr. Probst.
What is the job of educational radio? My answer to that is that it has the task of giving the better things in our culture a chance to be popular. Educational radio, properly done, can recall the richness of our civilization. Our civilization, with its ideals, its art, philosophy, science, literature, is the hushed, neglected part of radio. American radio, I think, ought to help the listener develop some ideas about the condition of man in the modern world, present the facts he needs, clothe these facts with significance, and aid in the improvement of human relationships. Porter, what do you think of that definition that I offer?
I think it's a very fine, ideal definition. I'm very much interested in whether or not educational broadcasters can set up objectives that will really carry out those goals, you see.
What about it, Wheatley?
And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. St. John 8:32. I take it that's what you're talking about.
I think that that's part of the richness of our civilization that it is our task to express. Here we have something really remarkable. American society is varied, it's complex. We all know the existence of commercial radio. Some people often ask me, and I've often had to explain, what is it that is the unique task of educational radio? How would you answer the question? I tried to open with my brief answer, Parker.
You have a philosophical kind of definition of the tasks. I would like to define these tasks more operationally. Let us begin at the beginning of life and serve our people from that beginning of life right to the very end of life. That means programs for parents and young children.
You're doing this in New England, aren't you?
We are doing,
what are you doing
this the best we can do. We do a program on pediatrics. We call it Your Baby. We try to tell the young mothers and fathers in New England and the grandmothers and grandfathers who are interested in these grandchildren what is known about the best way or the best ways to bring up these young children today. That's where we might start.
Aren't you saying, in other words, gentlemen, that the job of educational radio has got to be particularly related to the overall job of the colleges and the universities out of which these programs themselves come?
And we are also saying that the task of a university is the task of bringing the richness of the culture to the people. And an educational station as part of a university has the same job as a university.
And do you mean by culture, Probst, the way we think and feel and do things in our particular society here?
I certainly do. One of my proposals to illustrate the kind of responsibility I think we have, that does range, of course, all the way through the humanities down to last Tuesday, is let's take an educational station's microphones with some staff members for a day into the factory where people work and live, and see and hear what they have to say about the problems that they have. Hear them speak of the difficulties that they have and their doubts and so on, and give the listener a chance to be acquainted with more people in a closer form than he is in this society where everything is reported at such a great distance through so many barriers.
Well, now we're getting at some of those problems, I think, perhaps the objective through the process. Well, can't we together here for a few moments analyze the job in terms of the unfolding process that takes place? For example, obviously the first job of the college or university or the educational broadcaster is to examine the areas of need in the community. Would you agree to that?
Amen.
Then what's the next job? What should we do beyond that?
Well, the next job is that having decided what these areas are, the university must then look at its resources, the educational station must look at its resources and decide in what places can they get the most reward for effort expended. They may very well, for example, have some very, very fine, skilled, talented, exceptional men in the field of the Far East. If they do have, it is their task to bring these men forward at a time like this, with the troubles that we have here in Korea, and let the listener have the benefit of the background of these exceptional members of the university faculty.
And the listeners to WILL already know that some of the programs they hear are brought to them from other parts of the United States, produced by other educational broadcasters. So that if you want to fill a little hole in your own resources, or merely enrich your own resources, you may exchange programs with other universities and other educational broadcasters.
All right, now first we've analyzed the needs, then we look at the resources of the university. Now don't we have a job of trying to analyze, and I think this is a tough one for us, the processes, the ways and means of actually doing a job with these resources. In other words, there are some very real problems for the educational broadcaster that don't exist for the classroom professor, for example. I mean, we've got to recognize the medium and the audience's relationship to that medium. What are some of the problems there?
Well, they're all problems of judgment. Unfortunately, we don't have actual measuring sticks. We don't have a ruler that we can just put down on a problem and find out that the length is 6 3/4 inches and it's not good enough. We have to use our judgment and decide that faculty member A, appearing in a classroom doing a series on tragedy in Western tradition, can do a job that will appeal and get a tremendous response from listeners, and that this has been done and can be done, for example, up at the University of Wisconsin, and yet at the same time other places, staff in charge of educational stations have got to reject other people doing the same thing. There's got to be an actual professional judgment passed in the listener's interest to bring to the microphone the kind of talent that can take this richness and brightly and cleverly and glowingly bring it to life.
And Probst and Porter, here is where I think all of us have sinned. We have underestimated the ability of our listeners to educational programs, to commercial programs alike, to be interested in and understand and benefit from serious broadcasting.
Well, now, give us some of the evidences of that underestimation, can you? I mean, how have we done it?
I'll give you a concrete instance of the opposite sort. We have a broadcast which, according to one of the commercial surveys, had the largest listening audience on Saturday night, 7 to 7:30, of any radio program in the city of Boston and the five counties surrounding it. Now, the other stations had on one a so-called jukebox program, very popular music. One had on a light summer concert, light symphony music. Another had more recordings of some sort, but no programs of a serious nature on Saturday night. All right, the general theory is that nobody wants to hear anything serious on Saturday nights. But we had the largest audience, the largest proportion of all the people listening to the radio with a serious program with three professors.
Mm-hmm. Well, there just isn't any doubt that there is, in every individual, in every American, there is a vein of seriousness that is not appealed to by ordinary radio. He doesn't want to hear serious things all the time. That's not my position. But neither does he want to simply be flooded with entertainment without any variety and never any attempt to appeal to his dignity, appeal to his power to appreciate the more serious things in life. And when this is properly done with resources, in the style that an educational station does approach it with, it is successful.
Well, now,
haven't you found it the same way in Denver?
Well, yes, I think so. But I'm still trying to get from you, Parker, evidences of our former underestimation of the intelligence of the audience. How have we sinned?
The theory is that nobody will listen to serious programs. That is a very often stated and pretty well believed idea of most broadcasters. Even educational broadcasters feel that they can only get little audiences, minority audiences. Whereas right here at the University of Illinois, there's evidence being piled up to show that if a little attention is called to some good programs, the audiences not only double, but they triple and quadruple.
Well, I think you're getting to something very important now, too. Another job, isn't it, of the educational broadcaster or, let's say, of the university?
Yes, let the people know.
Let the people know that these programs are going on. We have sinned, I think, in this matter of thinking to ourselves, well, not very many people will be interested in these programs anyhow, so why try to promote them? They're bad articles to begin with. I don't believe that.
It's the long-haired view of higher education, and some people have it. In fact, a good many people in higher education have it, but educational broadcasting He's trying to close the gap between some of those people in education and our people as a whole.
Well, it's only since the last war was over that educational stations at the major state universities in this country have begun to have enough funds to even pretend to bring a university with all its resources and all its richness to the people through a radio station. And this is a phenomenal development. There are 105 of them educational stations now in the middle 30s. They got down, there are only about 25 or 30. And I think there is an increasing importance, an increasing value in the contribution that educational radio is making and will make in thinking about issues and in building appreciation in the American society.
And, Probst, some of these same university stations are not only broadcasting their programs over their own stations, as Wisconsin, with a network of stations, mind you, not just a station, but they are also broadcasting these same programs over the commercial stations in the community. The commercial stations want them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which is only further evidence, of course, that if a program is well done, it will get an audience. That, I think, brings us to another problem of the educational broadcaster, which I think is very, very important. That is that the educational broadcaster, it seems to me, has a unique opportunity to experiment with forms and methods and techniques of getting ideas over to people. We just can't assume that the ideas will stand by themselves, can we? I mean, we still have to get them to people in an attractive, imaginative manner, one way or another. Now, wouldn't you agree that we've got an opportunity there?
I agree with that. And many of the state universities are beginning to have communications centers attached to them where a certain amount of research on the attitudes of the public is going on, and increasingly there is the opportunity available to find out what the needs of the individual listener may be and what his appreciation of a program or his critical reaction to and dislike of a program may be. And I think it's going to be more and more possible for a program producer in an educational station to plan his programming in terms of known attitudes in the audience about it. And of course, we all continue to need the only yardstick we've had until now, and that is mail from listeners telling us what they do like about programs as they stand on the schedule today.
And what they don't like.
And what they don't like.
Well, I think we're discovering new methods, and we're discovering new patterns for doing these things, which I think are very important, and which, unless I miss my guess, are going to be picked up by broadcasters who don't have these opportunities to experiment.
Now let me turn to two other areas that I think that the educational radio can make a great service in. Briefly, I would say that an educational radio station can serve as an instrument to bring together people in the various divisions of knowledge, people who otherwise would never talk to one another. Physicists, economists, political scientists, historians can come together and talk about central problems. In this way, I think an educational station can be a force against the specialization and decentralization in education and in universities. Secondly, I'd like to emphasize that in the social sciences there are an increasing number of new techniques being developed. For example, there's a good deal of research going on what is the best size of committees. Now, I think every listener would like to know that elaborate research has shown that the ideal size of a committee for best results in getting problems solved is 6 to 7 members on a committee. And as soon as it is larger than that, the committee begins to break up in the same way that a drop of water breaks up when it becomes too big.
All those areas of knowledge are here. Can't we say that one of the principal objectives of the educational broadcaster is to be the most effective possible bridge between the educational institutions themselves and the people who are in the society which that educational institution is bound to serve? We're a part of education, and we've got to help do the job of education.
And we have the special service of bringing to the public the new research findings in universities.
Well, gentlemen, our time is up, but thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, be with us again next week when we present another in this series of visits behind the scenes in educational radio, The Universities of the Air. Our guests today were Mr. Parker Wheatley, director of Lowell Institute Cooperative Broadcasting Council, Mr. George Probst, director of radio, faculty member, and social scientist of the University of Chicago, and Mr. Russell Porter, coordinator of radio at the University of Denver. This was a tape-recorded feature of the University of Illinois Radio Service.